And this is KPCW's Local News Hour. Time is 8:06. Springtime in the air on this Thursday, March 27th. And with more on the weather in the Wasatch Back, we've got on the line ABC meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Good morning, Connor. Yeah, I'll tell you what, we are starting off on a somewhat of a mild note out there. Temperatures in the Heber Valley above freezing at 33 degrees. We've got temperatures that are pretty warm in Park City as well. As we go throughout the day, we are still expecting more sunshine. So very similar to yesterday, but you notice we will see a few more clouds that will be on the increase as we go throughout the day as well. So we'll call it partly to mostly cloudy skies by the afternoon hour. Still should be a fairly nice day out there as we see those high temperatures climbing into the lower 60s in Park City. And we should see those highs climbing into the upper 60s to right around 70 in the Heber Valley. As we go throughout the forecast for your Friday, we're going to be looking at, we'll call it mostly cloudy skies for your Friday. So not nearly as pretty, not nearly as warm as well. We'll be seeing a chance of a few scattered showers moving through the area as we go throughout the afternoon hours on your Friday with high temperatures into the upper 50s. So pretty decent cool down as we go into your Friday there with those southwesterly winds. Friday night, we'll see those showers continuing off and on. In fact, chances will increase as we go into your Saturday. Not expecting a complete washout, but the chance for rain showers in the Heber Valley will be fairly likely as high temperatures climb to near 50 degrees. Now for Park City, those rain showers will likely switch over and change into snow showers as we go into your Friday night into Saturday. So do expect the chance of some wintry weather as we go into your Saturday in Park City. Could even see a couple of inches of snow from that system as it moves on through. Again, that's in the Park City area. Heber Valley should be mainly just some rain coming down. Now Sunday is going to be your pick day of the weekend, as we call it, partly cloudy skies. Temperatures will start off into the mid to upper 20s in both Park City and in the Heber Valley, and we'll see those high temperatures climbing into the mid 40s in Park City with highs in the low 50s as we get into the Heber Valley. So should be a nice day as we get into your Sunday, and then we've got more active weather heading our way to kick off next week. So next Monday, we'll see increasing clouds once again. Temperatures will start off around the freezing mark, and then as we go into the afternoon hours, highs will be in the upper 40s in Park City and the mid-50s in the Heber Valley, and we'll see a few rain showers starting to develop as we go into your Monday afternoon into Monday evening. But Monday night, we get some colder air working its way in, and that means snow will become likely as we go into your Tuesday in Park City, and that one could be a little more significant bout of round or snow coming on in as we go into your Tuesday for Park City. But even in the Heber Valley, we're looking at the chance of some of that rain changing over with to snow as we go into your Tuesday. So we'll be keeping an eye on Tuesday. It will definitely be a day that, to watch for our potential next significant weather event, and that could stretch into Wednesday as well with at least scattered snow showers that will likely continue both in Park City and in the Heber Valley. But it's not going to be a frigid forecast. Temperatures by that time will be in the upper 20s by next Wednesday morning with highs in the mid-40s in Park City and highs in the low 50s in the Heber Valley. So it's kind of a roller coaster ride right now, Connor, with these up and down temperatures. But spring will continue to spring as we go throughout this afternoon.
All right, Cedric, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And with a look in the backcountry, we've got Drew Hardesty, forecaster at the Utah Avalanche Center on the line. Good morning, Drew.
Hey, morning. Beautiful spring morning. I look at the temperatures. It's been at least 48 hours since we've had a decent refreeze in the Cottonwoods anyway. And for, in some areas in the side of things, it's been even more, maybe three or even since there's been a decent refreeze. Coming on horrible across this morning will be earlier and narrower than it's been in the last few days. And the danger will rapidly rise again to considerable, generally on easterly and then southerly, then westerly aspects. And the temperatures are just so warm that even some of the mid and just touch of the upper elevation northerly facing aspects have gotten into the action. Some of the steep north facing chutes and couloirs people have been skiing. People reported some wet loose avalanches that have peeled out of there the last couple of days. And if you're booting up some of that stuff, you just got nowhere to hide. So again, dangerous avalanche conditions. We just desperately need a good lockup with the snowpack. Seems like that's on tap for the weekend, but for now it's probably best to do some spring cleaning or taxes and let the wet avalanches run.
Definitely watch out for the wet snow. Drew Hardesty at the Utah Avalanche Center, thanks so much. Well, coming up on the local news hour this morning, we'll speak with Summit County Councilmember Candace Hart about yesterday's county council meeting. Then we'll hear from the Utah Avalanche Center again, forecaster Dave Kelly talking about what he's called the year of the repeater. Then Park City Summit County Arts Council Executive Director Jocelyn Scudder stops by to talk about this month's gallery stroll and ongoing art initiatives in the county and city. Then tune in to Cool Science Radio at 9 a.m. This week, hosts Katie Mullally and Lynn Ware Peak will speak with Jill Heinerth, one of the world's premier underwater explorers and the first person to dive inside iceberg caves. On April 22nd, Earth Day, Jill speaks at the University of Utah as part of the Natural History Museum of Utah's lecture series. Then they'll talk with Ingrid Dabar, project staff scientist with Europa Clipper Mission that's on its way to study Jupiter's intriguing and icy moon. That's on Cool Science Radio today at 9 after the local news hour. Well, the news last night is that the Park City Planning Commission moved to deny a proposal to redevelop the DoubleTree Hotel on Park Avenue, also known as the Yarrow. Last October, a majority of commissioners didn't support a 10-foot height exception for the project at the intersection of Park Avenue and Kearns. However, there was no official vote in October. At that time, the project was continued to a date uncertain. The 5-1 vote yesterday ratified the commission's denial of the project. The owner of the property, Singerman Real Estate, did not make any major changes to the project since October. Singerman wants to demolish the decades-old hotel to make way for a modern mixed-use development. Buildings would be up to 45 feet tall, including a condo hotel, affordable housing, commercial space, and offices. The proposal exceeds the 35-foot height limit established by city zoning. A lawyer for the property owner argues the project would deliver numerous benefits, including the affordable housing, pedestrian improvements, and underground parking. Rick Shant was the sole commissioner to vote in favor of the proposal. He says it would improve the area compared to the existing hotel, which was built in 1977. Commissioner Bill Johnson said he was okay with the height exception, but had numerous questions about other aspects of the project. Several residents, including Mountainlands Community Housing Executive Director Jason Glidden, spoke in favor of redevelopment. The Planning Commission's vote can be appealed within 10 days. And Utah ski areas are starting to close for the 2024-25 winter season. And the Wasatch Back Deer Valley Resort closes Easter Sunday. That's April 20th. Park City Mountain's final day follows on Monday. Woodward Park City has not announced a closing date, offering lift tickets through April 13th. In other areas of the state, Beaver Mountain, Eagle Point, and Sundance close April 6th. Snow Basin Resort's final day is April 13th, and Powder Mountain offers lift tickets through the 13th as well, with no official closing date yet. Alta Ski Area's annual closing day celebration, affectionately called Frank, is April 20th, too. In Cache County, Cherry Peak is closed for the week because of the above-average temperatures, with plans to reopen tomorrow. The ski area has not yet announced an official closing day. Many Utah resorts plan to run past Easter, with Brighton slated to close April 28th. Brian Head has day tickets through May 4th. Solitude spinning lifts until May 11th. Snowbird hopes to close May 26th. And Nordic Valley has already closed on March 23rd. You can find that list at kpcw.org. You're listening to the Local News Hour. I'm Connor Thomas, filling in for Leslie Thatcher. And on the phone with me now, we've got Summit County Councilmember Candace Hart with a recap of yesterday's meeting. Good morning, Candace.
Good morning, Connor. Thanks for having me on.
All right. As I understand it, it kicked off yesterday with a site visit to the Silver Summit area where the county's expanding the Justice Center. Could you kind of give folks a summary of the project and its progress to expand attorney's offices and the sheriff's office?
Yeah, absolutely. I think quietly in the county, people would be surprised to realize just how much or how busy the sheriff's office is, and it's been growing over time as the population has grown, and the county attorney's office is in a similar position. So when you go into those offices, they're sharing desks. Like sometimes three people will rotate through one desk. We have other people that have literally been using a closet that's been converted into an office. So needless to say, we've gone as far as we can in the existing buildings. We're not getting rid of them, but we wanted to give them more space. So we're adding a new building, which is two stories, and it will be in front of the current sheriff's office and justice center, and it'll be the new main entrance into the sheriff's office, and that will house county attorney's offices, and it will also be the working area for the sheriff's department.
All right. And, you know, this project is less ambitious than before. It was initially going over budget to build a whole new building. So you kind of walked it back to this expansion of the existing facilities. How's the budget look right now?
Well, so far, it's two ways I guess to look at it. One, we're on budget, so in that sense, it's good, but it's still an expensive project. This is part of going back to when we purchased the Skull Candy building. We were able to buy the Skull Candy building for $17.5 million in a really prime location, and same thing, we really can use that space as well. But this new building, the one at the Justice Center, costs $25 million. So to build something new today, it's just a rather expensive proposition. I have to say that when we went over for the tour, you know, it's mostly if you're there today, you're going to see the steel framing is what you'll visually see. But when you get there, they have the renderings and they got the layout and you can see where the offices are. You can start to visualize it now. It really will be a very nice building. Nothing ornate or over the top, but just a really nice building that you'd be proud of as a Summit County resident if you went there. It will certainly greatly improve the work environment for the employees and make people feel better about being there. But yeah, it's about a $25 million building on budget right now. And the original building ideas were much bigger and a little more grandiose, and that price is getting up towards $40 million. And that was a bridge too far for us. We couldn't spend that much money.
And speaking of budget, you had the first quarter financial report attached to yesterday's meeting agenda. That's a little different. Sometimes the chief financial officer, Matt Leavitt, gives a full presentation quarterly about the financial health of the county. Based on your reading of the report and his data, is the county healthy after the first part of 2025?
Yeah, I mean, what we show right now is like year-to-date actuals is we spent, almost $14 million, like $13,880,000. But, you know, we still, in the budget, there's like another $76 million that still will be spent throughout the year, and that would just get us on budget. And so far, we're tracking on budget. So another way to summarize that for everybody is we've expended 15.4% of the budget so far.
And that was the main number. It was a one-page staff report, pretty 30,000
summary level.
If you did have concerns, how would you get more information? Do you get more specific numbers from the financial office behind the scenes?
Yeah, and certainly at different times of the year, we dig in deeper on certain areas. But Matt Leavitt, our financial officer, is really approachable and easy to speak with. So we would send Matt a request, and then Shane, we'd copy him, our county manager. And then the two of them would then answer to the council, you know, whatever questions or concerns we have. And when you think about county or council responsibilities, safety and well-being of the citizens of Summit County is our highest priority. And honestly, the budget is probably the next in what we actively work on the most. It's a key part of what the council does is manage the overall budget for the county.
Yeah, you budget every year. And would you ever consider budgeting every 2 years, for example?
I don't know. I mean, to the question of would you consider it, I guess it could be considered, but I personally don't think that would be something we'd be inclined to do. At least on a personal level, I like the idea. I'm much more detail oriented, so I like getting into the numbers and looking at by departments or line items. So the idea that I would go to every 2 years would kind of be the opposite of how I'm naturally inclined to manage.
Yeah, the county fiscal year being roughly the same as the calendar year. And there was already some discussion about budgeting yesterday with some council members attending a recent Chamber of Commerce meeting. And we've seen from Park City that they want to be very conservative with their budgeting process this summer. I guess there are global pressures on tourism. What's the situation, and are you expecting a conservative year for the county as well?
Yeah, because of the timing, so the city, when we say the city, we're talking Park City Municipal, you know, they're budgeting I think it's June, July, right, is their fiscal year, where the county's at the calendar year. So we really start to think about, will we be conservative, you know, which generally speaking, we try to be conservative every time, but that'll come up around the end of the summer for us when we really start openly discussing how we want to approach it. But the council has made it quite clear that, you know, we're not in favor of raising property taxes, at least the pieces we control. You know, there's things out of our control there. But, you know, we'd like to be conservative all the time if we can. The other thing is, for the county, the emergency services sales tax will really come online in 2026. So I think what it'll show everybody is it'll look like the budget's really gone up, and arguably it has, because that's money coming in, but that will all be used to offset the impacts of tourism. So if the projections are that tourism will be flat. We would budget accordingly. But that would affect Park City Municipal, I think, more than it does the county, because we provide services to so much of the unincorporated part of the county, which is our primary focus. And that's where the majority of the population in the county lives. So we're a little different, like where we're not as, we are tourism driven, but that affects Park City Municipal more than it does us.
All right. Well, digging into what you dug into during the work session yesterday, the meeting at the council chambers began with a discussion of arts and culture, and the Arts Council locally has been master planning. They kind of gave you a report midway. They'll have a full recommendation on the future direction of arts in Summit County later on, it sounds like. So what are they asking you for right now, and what were they able to show you yesterday?
Yeah, well, it's really kind of a lead up to the idea of getting a resolution of support from the county once they finish the report. And so the advice of the council we gave the Summit County Arts Council was to come before us and give us a progress report or an update. So instead of waiting to the back end and then everybody has to process it all at once, you know, we can bring people along and see what progress we're making. And just for everybody, you know, the county, Park City Municipal, and the chamber each gave money to the Arts Council to conduct this study. So we've asked for the study to be conducted, and then they're just giving us an update. They'll come back, and presumably, you know, everybody will sign on to this resolution of support, and that would be the goal for that.
You know, what's kind of driving this? The report they had yesterday has a lot of comparisons to mountain towns, and it seems like arts is, you know, the culture of the mountain, part of the culture of the Mountain West. And is there a sense that the lifestyle is lacking locally, or that they want to improve things? How often do they master plan like this?
Well, you know, you're hitting a really good topic, because I think arts, and this is, I'm kind of speaking for myself here, you know, as someone who's inclined to support the arts and culture, but we all, when we think about where we travel globally, we travel to places with great culture and art. And here we have lots of tourism, right? Recreational uses, whether it's skiing or biking or running or trails. And I mean, geez, everything, right? We live in such a playground. We just don't want to take our eye off the ball of making sure we're balanced and that we also have our own art and culture scene within Summit County. Because as much as I love to be out on my mountain bike or go running on the trails, I also love to go to a gallery and see great art as well. And there's different types of art that not everybody considers. Are you talking theater, you know, like a Park City film? Are we talking music? Are we talking, you know, oil on canvas? Are we talking sculpture, performance art? There's just so much. And so it's really easy sometimes as we're chasing down really important topics like affordable housing and senior services and, you know, our schools and all the things that really are essential to our, you know, sort of day-to-day lives. We just can't forget about arts and culture. And we need a study like this to help bring focus to it and then to also give us direction so we know where to put our energy.
And one thing that these master plans, or at least the report you saw yesterday, pointed to was, you know, the economic impact of the arts. And this is not something unique to this study, but sometimes when I read these things and I see this dollar invested gave this much return to the county in, quote, economic impact, it feels almost like it's pulled out of a hat. Arts frequently something cited as important for its own sake. I mean, do you buy the economic impact of that? Or do you take those numbers seriously? How do you evaluate that when you think about the government investment in art that they might be looking for?
Yeah, well, I mean, you touch on a really important, you know, conversation, which is, yeah, those numbers are real. There is an economic impact to tourism. People come in for, say, the Kimball Arts Festival. It's a huge economic draw as people travel here. It's one of the, I think it's a top four art festival in the country. So it does actually have real impact. But I think the reasons that we pursue art and culture, it's really the human experience, and it tells us much more about who we are as a people. And that you don't measure in dollars and cents. So from a government perspective, yeah, we need to track the dollars. We need to know if we're going to put tax dollars to use that we're going to get a return on investment. So mechanically that has to happen. But truthfully, we probably should all be reaching and supporting arts just because of what it does for us as a human race and just as a people. So I would say support it for those reasons. But yes, the financials are important.
All right, well, let's move on to the UDOT discussion yesterday. There was a presentation about the Utah Department of Transportation's plans for Kimball Junction traffic, always a hot topic, though looking all right today, potentially. They've gone with what's been called Alternative C. People who have been following it will know what that means. the best way to summarize it is they're just adding lanes. I mean, it feels like we came to this end of this five-year process and UDOT's unveiling their plans and it's just adding lanes. Is that underwhelming to you at the county?
You know, it's interesting because it does feel underwhelming. I think to most people, we were hoping for a much grander solution. You know, we had been meeting with UDOT, or especially over the last year, at some points weekly, on a pretty regular basis. And there were really kind of between what they would call options A and C. And what I should say is option C, which I'm sure we'll describe to everybody, but it's a subset of option A. And option A is, the breakdown of it would be, option A would be you'd have an off-ramp over by the outlets that would feed local traffic into the junction there. People would then continue to go up to the normal exit at 224, turn to head in the town. And then they would expand, so all the turn lanes become two left lanes. So right now, as an example, you get off of Highway 80, and where traffic's really getting jammed up is that first left at Ute Boulevard, are the cars back up into the through lanes. So essentially you take those two lanes and it gets crushed down to one. Then you have traffic coming from the other side of the bridge that kind of queues in there. Now you're waiting to make your right turn and you're missing your entire light movement while that's happening. So it's these turn movements are backing up into the through lanes. So the idea is by adding two lefts and two right lanes at each of the turns in every direction, that it will keep the traffic out of the through lanes, allowing cars to move through and, you know, stopping the queuing. So what we like about option A, there's pros and cons for sure, but what we like about it is it gives you an alternative exit point that we could expand to. So what UDOT is saying is they've gone with option C, which is all those turn lanes we were just talking about, just skipping the off ramp at the outlets. And they're basically saying that can always be added in later. So yeah, probably a little underwhelming, but at the same time, when you really sit down with traffic engineers, as much as all of us are always skeptical of traffic engineers, I've heard them consistently say that will be a noticeable change in the movements. And they're saying it's like a 30-year fix, but you know, I'm sure it'll fill back up at some point.
And it started from a field of like 30 options, getting whittled down to three, then two, then one here. You kind of described the extra exit on alternative A. I think some on council weren't so bullish on that because it would add more cars to Landmark, which you have separate goals as a pedestrian corridor. And then option B, I mean, y'all really liked that one. It was creating 224 into an underpass. It would eliminate the stoplights as a factor for people on ingress and egress. And I think especially on egress might have helped get rid of skiers, I guess, and prevent that mile and a half long backup that happens on 224 North. You said yesterday that you did have countless meetings with them over the past year at least. Did they actually incorporate some of your feedback into the final product that we're seeing?
Yeah, it's funny. I pause in that because I was thinking about, do they incorporate our feedback? We had lots of conversation around exploring what, I guess one of the things we did primarily is we went down and worked with UDOT and looked at like a conversation was like, all right, we have these options A, B, and C that we're talking about, but what else could we look at? And we explored so many variations of flyovers, different ways to cut through various properties that we didn't even own. We were just like, if we had access to this property, could we do this? We looked at, you know, when you option B for anybody tracking was we were going to sink 224 down, basically. So they call it a trench, but it would kind of get sunken down, and that would allow you to have overpasses at the intersections to just get that through traffic to move through there. And, you know, as we explored that and flyovers and stuff, then you have to look at the grade, you know, what the distance is to bring a car level. And it was going to really just, there was no clean way to do it. It just kept, every time we would do something that was grade separated, it would blow through intersections or cut off whole businesses to where you couldn't even get access to some of the businesses. So we are still thinking that there's a larger, grander solution. But in truth, you know, as much as we need to get 224 fixed, we need to get Highway 80-40 interchange addressed, and we need to get 248 interchange addressed over towards the city as well. So to some extent, it's like take option C, get this moving. They're talking about adding the turn lanes, kicking that process off next year. I think they're saying construction in or beginning part of 27. Get this underway, get us making some progress. Let's figure out 40 and 80 and 248 and then really just try to clean up this entire area. And that's essentially our pivoting, but Did they take our feedback? They certainly explored a lot of options with us, be fair to say.
And it's going to be about a $48, $49 million project in Kimball Junction. That's the estimate today. Will the county have to contribute anything to that, or is that all state money?
Well, what they're proposing would be primarily all state money, but there is something called betterments. And betterments would be, okay, so they look at it, they as in UDOT, right? They're purely thinking about traffic moving, right? They're not thinking about how nice does it look, or betterments are like beautification and things of that nature. Anything the county wants to do in that area, we would have to pay for. So if we say, great, you've got this design, but we want to alter the design aspects of the overpass or the underpass or the turn, then we are supposed to pay. But sometimes you can really have a negotiation with UDOT if they can find funding. So there are ways that more money can be contributed to a project. We also have to work with state legislators to, and this is part of when the whole Dakota Pacific conversation is, you get put, a project gets put on what they call the STIP, which is like a statewide, basically it's a list, right? It actually has hundreds of projects that they are considering. And you need to get on this list, then you need to move up to the top and then get your project to go to construction or to move forward. And when you're doing that, working with state legislators is a key part to moving that forward, and also funding. Sometimes they can find funding too for a project. So a lot to be figured out still there.
All right. We've been speaking with Summit County Councilmember Candace Hart. Candace, anything else you want to mention before you go?
No, just thank you, everybody. Please, if you have any comments or concerns or questions, email us at County Council. It's on the summitcounty.org website, and you can just hit County Council. We all receive it, and usually the chair receives you. But I hope everybody has a wonderful rest of your week.
All right, appreciate your time. And I want to note for the listeners, Summit County is a financial supporter of this station. We're welcoming the Utah Avalanche Center back onto the broadcast. Forecaster Dave Kelly is with me on the line to talk about this year in backcountry conditions and a little bit about the spring forecast. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Connor. How are you?
Good. So, you know, what caught my eye this week or last week was a blog post that you made on the Utah Avalanche Center's website. You've kind of dubbed the year of the repeater. Can you kind of explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, the year of the repeater falls back on the fact that we've had a number of avalanches this year that have all failed on the same layer of buried facets. Those facets formed, the backstory is that we got some snow early in the year into October and into November that did not melt. And that snow sat and pretty much faceted, which means that it had a very high temperature gradient, which means that the ground is 32 degrees Fahrenheit and the air temperature is very cold, you know, upwards of minus 20 Fahrenheit, minus 30 Fahrenheit, and that drives this process that creates these faceted crystals near the ground, which are pretty much just like, you know, white baker's sugar for the most part. And then when we had that really high and dry period where we didn't have a lot of snow in December, those facets just became more advanced, which just means that they're sharper. They play less well with incoming storms that are coming in. And then once we started to get snow in December, that's when we started to see the first series of avalanches, you know, right after Christmas into the new year, where we had a couple of fatalities in the central Wasatch, one in the East Bowl of Silver Fork, and then one in Mill Creek in the Porter Fork area. And then we went another period with no snow, and those facets again had an opportunity to further develop. And then every time we added additional snow and wind on top of them, those zones would avalanche again. And so the reason that they're repeaters is because they have an ability to just continue to sit with very shallow, weak snow near the ground. And anytime they get a slab, which is any heavier, higher density snow on top of them, it just makes for more avalanches on the exact same slopes.
So the slabs that are avalanching aren't taking that bottom layer that isn't very well glued together with them when they avalanche. And so the new snow continues to slide off the top.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. So that layer near the ground, it doesn't, when it avalanches, it doesn't like get pulled all the way back to dirt. Like you're not going to see a slope with no snow on it. Typically it just leaves a little bit of snow left. And then you get back to that place where you have that much higher temperature gradient because the snowpack is really shallow and thin again. And in that case, the snow, there is some snow that stays on the ground. So when people say an avalanche has slid to the ground, it means they can see rocks or wildflowers or summer surface poking through the snow, but as long as the temperatures stay cold and there's any snow on the ground, then that snow becomes faceted when we go into those cold, clear periods.
Yeah, I want to dig into kind of what facets are for people too. Of course, a major reason that avalanches happen is there can be a weak layer of snow, and when that, you know, exists over the whole season, that ends up getting called a persistent weak layer. And I think facets are a big part of why those PWLs form. Those are those crystals that aren't really glued together, and, you know, therefore the layers above or below those crystals don't glue together and can slide off of one another. How do facets form? Are those crystals falling from the sky, or is that a phenomenon that happens once the snow hits the ground?
It's a phenomenon that happens once the snow hits the ground. And so you'll have, say you get 6 inches of snow that falls, then another 12 inches of snow that falls. And so you have, you know, effectively 18 inches of snow that's fallen out of the sky. And then that snow will settle down. It'll still have the same amount of water content in it, but it'll settle down to say 10 inches of snow. And then you get this strong temperature gradient, which is when the ground itself is always at 0 degrees Celsius or 32 degrees Fahrenheit. And then the air temperature fluctuates to be very warm or very cold. And with a thin, shallow snowpack and a large temperature fluctuation, the water vapor moves between the crystals, and that's what makes them those hard, sharp, sugary crystals. And so facets are something that forms when they're on the ground, and they're also something that can form when you get new snow on top of the old snow if it's still a very shallow, thin snowpack, because that temperature gradient, or the change between the warm ground and the cold air temperature, is what drives that faceting process.
And as you wrote in your blog post, that same persistent weak layer of facets that formed very early season continued to avalanche into as late as February, and then another one appears to have formed here in early March. You also wrote that you can't trust a facet till it's melted. What's the process by which you get rid of facets, or that they finally become safe being in scare quotes?
Well, so there's the best way to trust a facet when you're in a season like this, where we have facets that extend all the way, you know, until the end of March, is it just has to melt away. At this point, most of the places within, not so much the central Wasatch, but say the skyline, which is just south of us, just south of our Provo region, they're not going to get enough snow to build a solid enough snowpack. And so what facets need midwinter to go away is they need a blanket of more snow. And so the seasons where you get, you know, 6 inches a day, 4 inches a day, 10 inches a day, just continuous, and it just continues to build a thicker blanket, for lack of a better word, are the years when the facets themselves will go away, because you decrease the temperature gradient by increasing the depth of the snowpack. So if you have a good season like we did a couple of years ago, where Alta reported 903 inches, we never really had a major facet problem because it just continued to snow, and that decreased the temperature gradient, which meant that the facets never had time to form. They just the snowpack just continued to bond to itself, and a thicker, deeper snowpack has typically less facets in it. And part of the reason that we've dubbed this year the year of the repeater is that we had those big breaks where those facets that had repeated and had avalanched pretty close to the ground had a chance to redevelop and then not get very much snow on them and then avalanche again. And that's why that persistent weak layer stayed mentioned in our avalanche forecast for so long, was that we just couldn't get rid of it because we couldn't get enough snow on top of it before it would avalanche again.
It sounds kind of like it's been a tough year then, because if you're waiting on a layer right next to the ground to melt away, you're kind of waiting on everything to melt away. I mean, I'm not a huge backcountry guy. The most extreme stuff I think I'll do are inbounds hikes, so I don't really know how the season's been. How are people feeling about this winter?
You know, it's been a very complex season because we've had that persistent weak layer, or those facets near the ground that have continued to be a player. Typically, we're done dealing with those on-the-ground facets by January or February, and part of the great thing about living in the Wasatch is that we don't tend to deal with these complex buried weak layers for all that long. The second persistent weak layer that we talk about, that of those elevated facets that formed at the beginning of March, those went away quicker because they were not as well developed. And so they were either beat down by the sun or, blanketed over by more snow. But it's been a much more complex season. Like, this is more typical of what you would see if you lived in Southwest Colorado or Southwest Montana. It's just a thinner snowpack with less snow and colder temperatures and more faceting going on. And so part of the reason that we wrote this blog, and the blog was a compilation that all of the forecasters put some effort into, because we wanted to have something to fall back on by saying, like, yeah, we're most likely not going to see a persistent weak layer problem in most places for the rest of the season, but there is a chance that you could see a persistent weak layer avalanche in these thinner, more shallow snowpack areas. And so we really wanted to not continue to harp on a persistent weak layer problem that was less likely, but also make people aware that the problem still could exist in the more extreme terrain. There's something to do with the mindset of how humans travel in the backcountry, where they have this like idea in their head that by the time you hit whatever, like St. Patrick's Day or whatever it is, that the snowpack is safe and you can start to ski these bigger lines. And in a season like this, you probably can, but those are the places where people are more likely to trigger those avalanches, or those higher hanging snowfields, that extreme terrain that the majority of our backcountry travelers think about is springtime terrain, because typically in Utah, that's the time to go ski that steeper terrain.
Yeah, we heard the immediate forecast from Drew this morning, the main thing to watch out for being wet snow as stuff melts. What's sort of the overall outlook that people are saying around the office for this spring?
That is the overall outlook. I mean, we pulled this persistent weak layer problem last week and could see into the forecast that we were going to have this major warm-up coming for the end of this week. And there's definitely a thought in the back of our minds that as water percolates down and hits those faceted grains for the first time, even in much deeper snowpack areas, that we could see some pretty big avalanches. But that would be a wet snow avalanche failing on a persistent weak layer. And we don't always need to get into the nitty gritty of what's happening as far as a public forecast, as far as a message gets conveyed to the public, because it would be too complicated if we were to say, you could see a wet slab avalanche failing on a faceted weak layer. This is going to be a wet slab avalanche that may have some characteristics involving that persistent weak layer. And so we try to put out a message that is clear rather than getting too deep into the weeds of things with all of the problems. And so we try to be very thoughtful with the message we're putting out to make it easy for people to make decisions, to say, yeah, you're probably not gonna trigger a persistent weak layer avalanche, but if you're out there at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a south-facing slope, you're gonna trigger a wet slide that may fail into persistent weak layer near the ground.
Definitely. Well, Dave, I appreciate your time this morning. Is there anything else that you wanna mention for the listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we really appreciate everyone who calls in, checks our website and asks all the great questions. And, you know, we really work as a community resource to provide the best forecast we can. And anyone who's submitting avalanches and observations to our website, you know, we rely on that information pretty heavily. Like we get out in the field as a forecast team. We have people out in the field every day. And we are a community resource, and the more information the community puts in, the better our product is going to be. And so we really appreciate what everyone provides to allow us to give the public a great resource.
All right. Well, we've been speaking with Dave Kelly, avalanche forecaster. Thanks so much, Dave.
Thank you, Connor.
And you can read the Utah Avvies blog at utahavalanchecenter.org/blog. Sitting here now with Jocelyn Scudder. She's the executive director of the Park City Summit County Arts Council. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. So the Arts Council, always very busy. Many events coming up. I think the one that we should maybe start with is Miners 9. You're putting out a call for artists. When is the next Miners 9? And it doesn't really happen in the winter, does it?
And I think that's due to how the Miners Hospital is rented out. But it is available in the summer months. And so to be clear, this is actually not an Arts Council program. This is a grassroots effort that was started by some local artists and longtime residents, Peg Bodell and Sundin Wolf. And it's called Miners 9 because it was a group of 9 artists that just wanted to show and sell their work on weekends at Miners Hospital. Hospital to take advantage of that centralized location. It's a great space. And so there are going to be six shows starting in April through September. And these shows take place 3 days during the last weekend of the month. So then the upcoming show is April 25th, 26th, and 27th. And right now, Peg and Sundin have put out a call for artists. And so they're inviting all artists with any artistic media to apply. And to apply, you can email miners9art@gmail.com. But this is just, it's a really great, again, grassroots effort for some local artists. I've been, and it's just a great showcase of different types of art. And again, it'll go April through September. So if you're a local artist and this perks your interest, you should definitely email Peg, again, at miners9art@gmail.com.
And is there a deadline to apply? The exhibits do go through September, so if you can't decide, can you reach out later?
You know, I'm not seeing a deadline here. I believe it's a rolling application, because if there aren't spaces in April, you can sign up for the May, June, July, August, or September slot. But I would just apply before those months.
Definitely. There is a deadline for Latino Arts Fest. That's April 1st. So
correct.
You know, this is June or July. What's the date for Latino Arts Fest this year?
So Latino Arts Fest is going to take place at Canyons Village at Park City Mountain Resort, June 13th, 14th, and 15th. And so we do have this is an Arts Council program. We've been running this for a few years now. And we have a call for artists and makers out. The makers portion is new. We are inviting fine artists to apply, and that's usually the focus of this festival. New this year is we are going to host something called El Mercadito. This is the brainchild of our festival manager, Andrea Zavala, really wanting to create that authentic festival experience and creating a market-like experience. And so we're also asking for people who are these creative entrepreneurs. If you make honey, if you make lip gloss, if you make jewelry or clothing, this is a creative entrepreneurial opportunity, in addition to if you're a fine artist, to apply to participate in this festival. And again, that the deadline for applications is April 1st, and you can find that application on our website at pcscarts.org.
And then even more immediate, tomorrow is a gallery stroll. So
yes.
What is this month's gallery stroll up to?
Yep. So Gallery Stroll, again, this is run by the Park City Gallery Association. There are, I think, around 15 galleries that are included in the association. Many of them do exist on Park City's historic Main Street. There are a handful of galleries off Main, such as Crate PC, Jago Gallery, and even Bill Cranstover Gallery out in Peoa. And so this is a monthly activation that the Gallery Association hosts. It's every last Friday, and it takes place from 6 to 9 p.m. And usually the gallerists host special shows. Sometimes they'll have artist talks. And so, you know, my recommendation for people who are interested in this event is to maybe pick a few that you might want to check out. And usually each gallery has an exciting exhibit or something new to talk about. If you're interested in the participating galleries, you can find out more at parkcitygalleryassociation.com.
I didn't realize Eastern Summit County galleries participate. It has always felt like kind of a Park City-centric event. How many Eastside galleries do you get?
There is only one currently participating, and it is Bill Cranstover. You know, I mean, I think it started as a Park City event, but it's an opt-in opportunity. It is a membership fee to be in the Gallery Association and to receive the benefits that the association provides. And I think Bill Cranstover has been a longtime member, and I think it's a great, you know, it's fun to go off the beaten path every once in a while. But obviously there is a higher concentration of galleries in Park City versus the east side of the county.
Stroll all the way down the rail trail.
There you go.
And I want to ask, so you were also at the county council meeting yesterday, and you gave an update on the arts and culture master planning process, also the roundabout art, which is going to be quite the monumental, noticeable public art change coming down the pike this year at the Jeremy Ranch and Pinebrook roundabouts. What's the update, and how is the artist team doing?
Yeah, the artist team is working really hard. We gave an update to County Council last night providing some progress photos of some of the sculptures. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with the project, the county manager back in 2019 prioritized this project, wanting when the Jeremy Ranch roundabouts were reconstructed. Those were fairly new at the time, and I think it was Tom Fisher was the county manager at the time and was really inspired by roundabout art that he had seen on different city tours. Obviously, there's roundabout about art that exists in thousands of examples throughout the nation and internationally. And this just seemed like a really wonderful blank canvas to not only place public art, but really showcase this area as a gateway to Summit County. And a lot of times art can be this kind of creative placemaking tool to serve as that identifying factor. So when people come in to Summit County, they are welcomed now by the selected artists are going to be constructing a very large scale moose sculpture, about a 25-foot moose sculpture, and also a sandhill crane sculpture. And this was, this is a Summit County Commission appointed by the county manager, and our 9-person volunteer board members worked really hard to select these artists. And it was really important, and I think it resonated with the board, and also when we received public comment, to represent local wildlife in these roundabouts. It's artwork that people can connect to, and it does tell a story of who we are as a Summit County residents. There's actually, I think, some nesting sandhill cranes right by the Jeremy Ranch golf course right there. And so I think that's reflected in the artwork as well. And so as we lead up to the installation, we are going to be engaging some local school children and going to Wileman School of Discovery, Park City Day School, Wileman, Ecker Hill Middle School and Jeremy Ranch Elementary. And we are going to be talking about the value of public art, but we're actually going to be doing a naming contest with these kids, which should be really, really fun. We're excited to see what these kids might come up with. But I think what we want people to do is to have ownership over these sculptures. I think they're going to eventually be pretty iconic because they are very visible. Thousands of people are going to be driving by them every day. And they're going to be constructed and installed this summer. So we're going to be doing some community engagement with school children this spring. And then you'll be seeing a moose and a sandhill crane, pretty two iconic characters coming this summer in the roundabouts.
Yeah, so kids listening in the backseat right now should start thinking of their best moose crane names.
Yes, exactly.
And 2019 was when the funds were appropriated for this too, right? Because I think there's a $198,000 budget for this, but that is already appropriated.
Correct. Yep. And then the funds were, we use the word frozen because, of course, we didn't really know how to talk about the pandemic and how we had to shift priorities. But the funding was reprioritized and approved, I think, in 2022, 2023 timeframe. And we put out an RFQ and received a lot of responses in 2023. So this has been a long process. And it's a really exciting project to continue to build this sense of identity through public art for Summit County.
And, you know, what other events are you looking at kind of down the road, maybe wine festival and what's going on at the Create PC space?
Yeah, so actually next weekend, April 4th and 5th, the Park City Wine Festival is going to do a spring activation. I think for those of you who are familiar with the wine festival, they're usually here up at Canyons Village in the fall, but it's become so popular they decided to do a spring event. And so they'll be up at the Pendry Plaza on April 4th and 5th. And they've identified us. We've decided to work with them as a nonprofit partner, and we're going to do a Create PC pop-up. Those of you who are not familiar with Create PC, it's a local artist collective that the Arts Council runs. It's our only brick-and-mortar space where we host a kind of creative marketplace retail gallery. We host over artwork and creative goods of over 50 local artists and makers. And then actually upstairs, there's 10 studios where we have 10 artists in residence. These are artists who have 24-hour access to their studios. They can gather, they can create, they can keep their paints out. This was an initiative of the Arts Council filling a gap for something that we've heard a lot from local artists. And so we have this great space. It's on Kearns Boulevard at 1500 Kearns. But it's a little hidden back there. The rent's great, and it's we're so lucky to be able to experiment with this proof of concept of this local artist collective co-op model with local artists, giving them a home. But also we want to get back out in the community. And so we're doing a Create PC pop-up where you'll see between, I think, 15 to 20 artists exhibiting and selling work over those 2 days at the Pendry Plaza. So if you're interested in wine and art, you should look up the Park City Wine Festival, parkcitywinefest.com. I do believe it is a ticketed event, so you can make your choice there. But hopefully it'll be really nice weather and a great excuse to go try some wine and meet some local artists.
All right. And we've been speaking with the Executive Director of Summit County Park City Arts Council, Jocelyn Scudder. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And thanks for tuning in to the Local News Hour this morning. I'm Connor Thomas, filling in for Leslie Thatcher.